Any question? Huh? Or anybody in general?
Questions?
Any question you want to demonstrate?
You know the chanting that you did earlier?
Uh-huh.
Is it in English somewhere? I know some of them are, but are they all in the book?
No. Bits and pieces, but not in this book. Other books. But I think you can Google just the first line. Yeah. Of those chants, any chants you want to be in English, they will.
Okay, I'll write them down.
Yeah, that's how they might have it, I think. I think that might be right. I think Kalyana put one in English. Question for the Dhamma talk, but otherwise.
Oh.
Yeah, I think he did a lot of. Yeah.
All right. I'll have a look in there.
He did? Yep. Yeah. Well, now in there.
I have a question.
Okay, yeah.
Did you hear an answer last week?
Okay, yeah, that's good.
Lowering your standards.
Uh huh. Expectations.
I see. I guess I've been contemplating a bit.
Yeah.
I think I'm a bit similar to standards.
Ah, okay, yeah, sure.
But I guess it's all very good to have that theory, but it's like, how do you know your standards? How do you know when? How can you identify when you have expectations and what they are? Because I reckon that's half the trouble. It's not so much changing them, it's just recognizing that you have those expectations. How can you be more aware of what your expectations are?
Okay, I worked that into it. Yeah, sure, no problem.
I have a question
for you. Okay. Yes, go ahead.
It's about equanimity and wisdom. It just seems to me like you'd have to be just about like enlightened to be able to pull off equanimity. So,
yeah.
I don't know.
Okay. I'll try to work that in there somewhere. We'll wait for another minute or two, see what Tuti coming in, or he's working on the plumbing. Yeah.
If consciousness, if there's no self, and then consciousness is not really. How does it move on? If there's not, you know, what's actually the next manifestation of the reincarnation? If there's no real self and consciousness is not movable to another, what actually is moving on?
Yeah, sure. I think it's a common question. I think, the different ways the Buddha explained it or different teachers explained it. Yeah, maybe it's getting craving, energy. And there's something to move on, but it's not a self because it's not fixed.
Is it a subconscious thing? Is it a subconscious?
No, it's a thing. But not a specific thing. Like, it's not you moving on. You can be, you know, an animal, a man, a woman. Right, so it's not you moving on, but then it is a specific, your specific,
but there's an
comic
essence
thing.
There, is
yeah,
there?
Yeah.
Is there an essence of?
No, there's no essence, but it's something moving. Yeah, so it's like, you know, some people describe it like a DNA, I guess, or you know, when you light the candle and you use the candle to light something else, what goes across? Right, not specific, just the heat, it's the craving.
Just the elements.
Yeah, the heat, the craving, some kind of energy, craving. So they're similar, but desire, but it's not fixed. That's the thing.
Nothing is certain. nothing is fixed.
No, it's not fixed, like it's not little you moving from one lifetime to another lifetime. But obviously, your consciousness gets reborn in a different way than another person's consciousness, Namari's consciousness. It's not little Mari or little Dirk that moves from lifetime to lifetime. But it's not the same either. Obviously, you guys, you know, have your own path to move on from one to the other. According to your own craving, you move differently. Yeah, but it's not a fixed thing. So it's sort of like, a soul is not a bad thing, but the only thing the soul is because it implies
that there's... There is no soul, is
it? No, the Buddha doesn't say, yeah, but there's something that moves from lifetime to lifetime.
There is something.
Yeah, obviously, yeah, there's something. But it's not a fixed thing, so that's the main thing. That's what he's trying to get at, that you're not a fixed entity. It's not a little thing that moves on and that cannot change, because it changes all the time. Yeah. So like the river, right? It's not the same water that moves, but it's certainly there's a river moving from one place to the next, right? But it's not the...
You can't name a river because it's always flowing. Yeah.
It's flowing different places, yeah, just you can't see.
Like, flow into one...
No, it doesn't flow in anything. So I've been... It's a simile. It only goes so far, yeah, it doesn't... There's not a big consciousness that we go into or anything, obviously. We don't melt into
it's
a big consciousness. No.
We
don't do any of that. No, we don't do any of that. That's more Hinduism, where they melt into...
Some people say we're like spiritual beings and
right.
Have come to a solid state
right.
And then we return to a spiritual place.
No, we don't. Buddhism is not so much
not,
that. That's more kind of new agey stuff. Yeah. No, we don't move from anywhere, go anywhere. Other than this, it's like big bang and big crunch. It just is. We just move from one lifetime to the next, over and over again. And like Buddha said, there's no starting point. There's no starting point discernible.
So
there's no ending point discernible either.
It's not linear.
No, not linear. It's more circular.
Circular.
Yeah, but then also, what's the first cause? Well, yeah, that's just a philosophical position we take. Buddhism, there's no first cause. Yeah,
there's
always
an ending. Isn't that enlightenment?
No, in samsara. But there's an ending, an individual ending if you become enlightened. But samsara goes on and on and on, whether there's Buddha or not, right? Buddha doesn't stop samsara. Yeah, it just goes on and on. Except if you are, who? Dhammakaya. Dhammakaya stops samsara. But normal Buddhism don't stop samsara. Samsara just goes on and on and on and on. But according
so
to...
You can't end samsara.
No. Wait. Samsara doesn't end, but you end your own samsara by becoming enlightened.
But isn't sunatā like emptiness? Is that?
No.
No, it's emptiness. The Buddha said it's emptiness
voidness,
of certain things.
The voidness.
But that's another way of looking at things. Voidness of depends on we would say there's many type of emptiness.
Yeah.
And it's not emptiness of complete emptiness, but it's emptiness of different things. Like when you're sitting here, you're empty of the activities in Sydney. And then when you go through samadhi, you're emptiness of thought. Yeah. And then when you become enlightened, you're empty of craving. But it's not complete, like utter destruction, just empty of, the negative stuff.
Actually,
what's left is positive stuff.
With that question, I heard Ajahn Mahabhor say, enlightened, nibbana is not atta and it's not anatta.
But that's the thing, yeah.
It's not both. So it's not, you can't explain in word because it's
yes.
There's no language for it.
And the same thing, yeah, because you think it doesn't go there, obviously, you can think your way to nirvana. Yeah, so that's also part of the tricky issue of trying to describe these things or name it.
But nirvana's not a place, is it? Or is it
no, it's not a place.
It's
a mental state.
It's a mental state,
yeah.
And is a Buddha a mental state? Being a Buddha, is that a mental state as well?
It varies. It depends how you look at it. I mean, like you can say we all have Buddhas inside of us or whatever. But Buddha, there is a real Buddha. But then there's also the figurative Buddha. It's like, a president. Yeah, it's an office. Different people occupy it at different times. Yeah. There are different Buddhas throughout history, obviously, throughout time. Yeah, so it's not only one Buddha.
There was hundreds of Buddhas before the Buddha.
That's right. Yeah, different cosmic time. Okay, anyway, I'll get started. Titi looks like he's busy. tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa buddhang dhammang sanghang namasami. So, so as promised, I was going to go on from last week's reading of the Satya Samyutta in the Samyutta Nikaya. The Satya Samyutta is the that chapter on the Four Noble Truths. And just a recap of last week, the Buddha talked, you know, placed a strong emphasis on this Four Noble Truths that he taught. He said, you know, if you're gonna, if the monks are gonna talk about anything, you should talk about the Four Noble Truths. If you're gonna think about anything, instead of think about sensuality, thoughts of irritation, thought of ill will, you should think about what's the Four Noble Truths. And then he said, you know, if you ignorant is not just not knowing anything. Ignorant is only specific to not knowing the Four Noble Truths. And just, you know, all future arahant, all present arahant, and all past arahant became arahant because they penetrated, understood the Four Noble Truths. So obviously this Four Noble Truths, for the Theravada tradition anyway, has a strong importance on the practice and of the on the way what Nibbana is and what do we think and how do we cultivate obviously we want to practice, we want to progress on the path, and reflect on the Four Noble Truths, become more familiar with it. It's one of the important aspects of our practice. So, and also remember, it's the first teaching he gave. The it was a Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. 3 months after he became enlightened, the first teaching he gave to the five ascetics, his five friends, is the teaching regarding the Middle Way, but also basically the Four Noble Truths. So it's something that's important, it's essential in the teaching of the Buddha. And you would probably question, here's the Buddha, fully enlightened, bliss beyond imagination, so much happiness that he apparently is supposed to say that he just stood in one place for 7 weeks, just staring at the Bodhi tree from a different angle, because so much happiness that he didn't need to do anything. You need to eat, you need to go anywhere, you need to go tell everybody, you're just so happy. But then he started thinking, okay, you know, how should I spread the teaching? How do I, you know, out of compassion, how do, you know, get other people to understand reality, to be free from the suffering? You know, how do I pitch this? Nirvana, it's interesting, and he talked about suffering. He said, oh, that's not very enlightening, Buddha. You just became enlightened. Not very inspiring. Why don't you talk about love and happiness and light and freedom? But he didn't. First word out of his mouth was suffering and the end of suffering. But that's the remember. So what he did. He did teach about beauty and light and love. And that is the freedom from suffering. Because he looked around, obviously. And, you know, there are different types of suffering that each and every being, just not human being, are immersed in. And the way out of that is, to understand, to know that. What is it? So, the first noble truth, obviously, is that there is suffering. But some people misquote the Buddha and says, well, you know, Buddhists are such pessimists. Oh, you talk about suffering all day long. Sickness and death. That's just the first half. I'm getting to the second half. And there is, but that's the irony of thing. And we all do that. When you meet with suffering, the first instinct is to not even acknowledge it, to pretend you're not suffering, or to run away from it, to distract yourself in different things, to distract yourself in, you know, food, shopping, watching TV, relationship, talking to your friends, or whatever. We all want to run away from that. And that, as a result, we keep repeating the mistake, repeating the suffering over and over again. So Buddha said, you know, the way to transcend suffering is really to understand it. Understand where is it that we're, you know, attaching. Where is it that we attach? Where is it that we make a problem out of life? Where is it we're not relating correctly? Where is it that we're seeing wrongly? And part of it is, yeah, like I said, is so the Buddha said, you know, how does he classify suffering? Many types of suffering. Not getting what you want, pretty obvious, suffering. Always sickness and death, not very fun, suffering. Separated from what you love, one, the things you like, suffering. And even more annoying, the things that you love start to change on you. So more suffering, right? And then, but yeah, so that's all different ways that we suffer, because the suffering doesn't come by itself. It's because, you know, things change, and because we attach. And he says, you know, what is the origin of suffering? Right? So these are the, you know, first the obvious suffering, not getting what you want. And then, you know, what is the origin of suffering? Buddha said, origin of suffering. It's not out there. It's not somebody else. It's not a god that made you suffer. It's not your parents. They did the best you could. Even if you had terrible parents, that's not their fault. That's not the cause of your suffering. It's not your parents. Or your sisters or brothers. Or the government. No, no. The cause of suffering is... Not even your brother and sister that you're annoying you so much. They're not the cause of your suffering. Not even your spouse, your partner. Even if they cheat on you, lie to you, steal your money, sell your money. No, that's still not the cause of your suffering. The cause of your suffering is craving, right? You want something, you're not getting. You expect something that you're not getting. Your standards are too high. But I think... the Buddha named three, but I'll just focus on in a different way. There's, you know, craving for sensuality, craving for good food, good sight, good sound, good smell, good, body sensation, comfort. And then there's craving. I mean, you don't get what you want, then you crave to have the opposite, annihilation, craving not to be. You want to be somewhere else, be another person, be with somebody else. So that's also craving that also brings suffering. And then, what's the other one? And yeah, craving for... That is right. Oh, yeah, yeah. 22-3 craving. Craving for you know, good food. Craving for existence. You want to be somebody. Be recognized. Be loved. Be liked. Now, you don't get that, then you don't want to. Then you don't want to be. You start. You want to off yourself. You want to hang yourself. You don't like what you want. You want to go somewhere else. You want to be with another person. So craving for annihilation. So those are the three craving that, you know, brings suffering. And then this is the good stuff. There is the origin of craving, right? But also there is a cessation. Craving ends. Craving does go away. But it doesn't go away by itself. It's causal. It goes according to causes and conditions. So we have to establish the causes that ends craving. Or you have to establish the cause that brings happiness to your mind, freedom from suffering. And the cause of that is the Eightfold Path. You know, you have to practice. Yeah, so it's okay to want to be happy, but it doesn't come by itself. It doesn't come by praying. It doesn't come by chanting. It comes by, you know, practice. A bit of practice. It comes by having right view, but it also becomes by practicing, you know, the Eightfold Path or the Threefold Path. That, you know, the kind of in the Forest tradition, they summarize it. Sila, Samadhi, and Panya. Like harmlessness, virtue, stillness, concentration, and then wisdom. And it's wisdom is not, like I said, you know, having a smart brain, fast brain who can think and invent or have clever ideas or clever sayings or can write beautiful things. The wisdom, in the Buddhist perspective, is the wisdom to be free from suffering, wisdom to see clearly, when you see clearly, the mind lets go, or it doesn't attach to begin with. When you don't attach, then you're happier. But it comes, you know, and sometimes you see, you know, and this is a bit of equanimity comes in, that we think happiness comes from likes or dislikes. You maximum your likes, be around the people you like, always get what you want, that means that makes you happy. And then you minimize your dislike. Stay away from the people that you don't like, stay away from things that make you feel uncomfortable. It's like a perfectly well-controlled room that you're in all the time. You have your own, walk around your own little bubble. When it's 40 degrees outside, you're constantly nice and 20, 15 degrees, 20 in summer. And then in the winter, when it's 2 degrees outside or 5 degrees, you're in your little bubble and it's only 20, 25. And I think that's kind of happiness. Just getting, controlling the ability and the power to control everything around you, the world around you. All your friends always say nice things, you're always surrounded by your loved one, they always say nice things to you. They never say mean things, they criticize you or lie to you or cheat you. And then other people you don't like gets banished out of your awareness. I think that brings happiness. But it doesn't, really. You think about it, because the world is a big and complicated place. It's usually doesn't go according to our likes and dislikes. And that's why on Wednesday night's talk, when Ajahn Chah Sarah was talking about it, you know, equanimity is just freedom from suffering. When you're equanimous, or when you practice, you aim to be equanimous, you're free from your likes and dislikes. That when you meet somebody you like, you don't get overly excited. You say, oh, the thing's wonderful, and you know, my friend, you know, this is, I like this person, is a super good person, is a great person, is a God because I like him. The person you don't like is an evil, and there's nothing positive about them because you don't like them. No, if you're equanimous, then you're free from this kind of ups and downs that you're faced with in life. Because the situation changes. The people that you like, sometimes they do silly things to annoy you. And the people you don't like, they also have, you know, very redeeming qualities that sometimes we overlook because we like to generalize. We like to paint the same brush that, you know, so-and-so is annoying, they'll always be annoying. No, people can change and things can change and your feelings can change. And that's the Buddha keeps saying over again, you know, things are impermanent. Everything is changing. You know, external world, also all internal world, our perception changes according to our mood, according to our, you know, what we see. And sometimes, you know, and that's why it's interesting to be in a monastery. A lot of things don't change. So you can see your reaction to things. But, you know, like I said, we give a common example that, you know, you sit, you live with the same monks over and over again. So you can see them act, and there are some monks you get along with, your friends, some monks you don't have so much in common with. These are not your friends. But then they change over time. The people, monks that you find really annoying for the first 5 years or 10 years of your monastic life, so sometime along the line they change, and you can become really good friends with them. Other times, you have friends that you're really close to, and you move apart. So you realize, yeah, you know, you can see. But if you're outside, and you change, people knowing you, you just move away from them, you don't never get to see. You just think that, you know, that your perception is something that's fixed, that these people are not are fixed, and they're not. But even if you are, you know, moving around in life, you can see that, you know, sometimes, you know, when you, you know, you in a work situation, a family situation, or whatever, that you can't move away from people you don't like. Or your loved ones, you know, you have a disagreement with your loved one, you don't talk to them anymore. And you see that all the time. You know, family members or whatever, they have something, and then, you know, they stop talking to each other, or they don't see each other because, you know, something happened. So they kind of froze. So that's the thing with likes and dislikes. It is, you are a slave to certain habitual reactions. And then when you practice equanimity, you're saying to yourself, yeah, I like this person, but that's not the whole picture. That's just your friend. I mean, that doesn't mean everything they do is wonderful. They can have, you know, weaknesses and mistakes and do rotten things from time to time. They may not do it to you, but you can see they can do other people. Or the other person, when you meet with a situation you don't like, person you don't like, you might say, well, you know, this is how things are here, like this. But it's not always going to be like this. And also, more important thing is, if you have a stable mind, equanimous mind, you can be with both. That being with unpleasant situation, unpleasant person, it's not that bad. It's not going to kill you. So it gives you a space around it that you're not constantly having to manage, control your environment, because you to maximize your likes and minimize your dislike. You're equanimous, you're safe, you're peaceful, you're still. Because as long as we have likes and dislikes, there's always trembling. They're trying to move towards more light and move away. So there's always a moving, shifting, kind of managing things. But the less you have likes and dislikes, or the more you have a kind of an equanimous attitude, more clearly you see, oh yeah, this is just my, I just don't like this, don't like this person, not the end of the world. But I'm just going to hold that thought. I'm not going to act from it. I'm going to hold that. I'm not going to make a big deal out of it. And just see what happens. Sometimes, you know, things, people change, life change, situation change beyond our expectation, beyond what we think is possible. Because a lot of time we're not reacting to the external situation, not reacting to the person or the situation. So more you're more still. And that's the thing. As you become aware of what's happiness and suffering, a lot of times just the trembling, the movement towards thing and away from thing, it's a lot of suffering. Because it brings, you know, anxiety. It brings, you know, any kind of movement. It brings as the disturbance to a peaceful mind. You're peaceful, you don't worry. You're not having to plan to get things into your sphere, or push things out of your mental sphere. You're not having worry to manage the situation. Mind, oh, what's tomorrow? I've got to make sure the right people come to cook the right food. Otherwise, I won't get my food, I'll suffer. Or whatever it is that you attach to. Or, you know, oh, I don't want, yeah. So the more likes and dislikes you have, and the stronger you hold on to them, obviously you create a sign of anxiety, worry, trembling around the situation when they change. And that's why equanimity is something to work with, and it's one of the spiritual perfection. It's equanimity. But sometimes people have the wrong idea. They say, oh no, I'm Buddhist, I shouldn't have any preferences. I shouldn't say anything. I like what kind of food I like. Certainly monks, you shouldn't say you like this or like that, or like this person or like that person. I should love everybody the same. It's a nice idea. But that's not what equanimity is about. Equanimity is recognizing that you have likes and dislikes, but not to really buy into the whole story. You know that your preferences is conditioned by your background, by, you know, who you are, what you are, where you're growing up. And that your likes and dislikes is just that much that, you know, getting what you want, you're not going to live happily ever after, forever and ever, things will change. And not getting what you want, you're not going to die from it. Right? You're not going to die from being in an unpleasant situation or having a sickness or not getting your way. And sometimes not getting your way is liberating. Because when things go wrong, you're not responsible. You don't get your way. I told you to build it this way. You guys didn't build it this way. Well, now you're falling down. It's not my problem. Or whatever it is. Well, you didn't pick the color. Someone else picked the color. Well, that's okay. Someone's complained. It's not my problem. So not getting your way sometimes can be quite liberating, because it points to the reality of things, that the world moves according to different causes and conditions. It doesn't move according to our wishes. It doesn't move according to our plans. So then we don't get caught up in this sense of, you know, identification with things and kind of the fact that we're responsible for things if it doesn't turn out well. So that's the reason why you know, well, as we practice, you acknowledge. It's not about kind of pretending that we don't have likes or dislikes, but also not to buy into things we like and things we don't like. It's the whole story. It isn't. Yeah, not getting what you want, you're not going to die from it. really. And you, and it allows you this, like Ajahn Chah Sarasara on Wednesday, allows you this kind of spiritual space that says that you can hold on to these things, you can hold unpleasantness, you can hold on to suffering and not be overwhelmed by it. That's just because you don't get what you want, you're not going to die from it. Right? If it's too hot, too cold, you get sick, you're not going to die from these kind of unpleasant situations. Someone, you know, you had a huge argument of people. Well, you're not going to die from that. It's not pleasant, but, you know, it's not the end of the world. So that's the reason why equanimity is a spiritual perfection to practice, because it also liberates you. It inclines you towards freedom. Freedom from, you know, grasping. Freedom from trying to control, manage things so that you maximum your likes and minimize your dislike. And like I said, each and one, every one of the Four Noble Truths, you know, is leading towards freedom. Freedom from suffering. Freedom from attachment. And the more free you are, the happier it brings. The more peaceful you are, because you're not constantly trying to move, manage, control things around you to get what you want. So whatever happens, you can imagine, whatever happens, you're at peace. People, pleasant situation, everything goes according to exactly what you ever wish and fantasize about, you're at peace. Everything, the whole world turns upside down, they elect liberal into the government, because you don't have likes and dislikes, you're not shaken, you're not annoyed. Trump wins the presidency, you say, sadhu to Trump, and he do a good job. You don't panic, you don't try to move to Canada, you don't start to complain, you're at peace. Or whatever it is that annoys you. And sometimes you see that, you see, you know, you're getting worked up over things. So you keep asking yourself, you know, is this happening or suffering? If you're getting worked up, getting annoyed, feeling unhappy, then there's an attachment, there's an expectation there somewhere. And like I said, I was saying last week, that the thing is to, yeah, when all else fails, you're suffering so much, or if you're getting so worked up, so annoyed, then lower your expectation. What do you want from life? Sometimes, you know, we buy into the magazines and the TV and the media of, you know, life should be perfect. Should be a big bulb cherry. Should always get what I want. Should always get my promotion. Always meet the right person that will always say the right thing all the time. Even for monks, I should always get my samadhi, my jhanas. Should get my, become a stream mentor my first month as a monk. After that, maybe once returner, non-returner, but no more than 5 years. I've got to finish all my work with 5 years. I have things to do. I have books to write. I have jobs to get to. Or whatever it is that we plan about. But, you know, even that, sometimes it doesn't meet. Or sometimes when we sit, you know, okay, maybe not every single session I have my jhana, but at least in 9 out of 10. Surely 5 out of 5. I put on the road, I gave up so much, you know. But I don't have my jhana. Well, do I have nothing? Now, you know, after a while, you know, you lower your expectation. It's just nice just to sit. Nice just to watch the breath. You can't watch the breath, it's just nice, you know. Just be healthy enough, I'm a healthy body, and I can sit. I don't have to run around in the world, crazy place of Sydney, and try to find parking space or whatever it is. You know, most people have to do. I don't have to go to work, you know, spend, you know, 10 or 12 hours a day, you know, earning a living. Not that it's bad, because a lot of you guys do it. But it's certainly not as peaceful as sitting here watching your breath, even if your mind is going crazy, even if it's not settling down, even if it's restless. You know, and you can reflect on the different ways. So you keep lowering your expectations. It's just nice to sit here. And as you lower your expectation, as you have more gratitude, a contentment, whatever is happening, the mind becomes more still, naturally. It doesn't, you know, and the less you want, the less it moves. And when it doesn't move, it becomes still by itself. And then, you know, the pleasantness, the stillness, the snowball effect, the rapture starts to happen naturally, because I'm not wanting so much, not craving, not longing for things. And the world, yeah, sometimes, you know, you say it was normal to long for things, to want for things. True. But the more mindful you are, the more clear you are, the more you see that whatever it is that you long, you know, the more you want things, the more uptight you get, more stressful you get. And even that subtle longing for things, it shakes the mind a little bit. You're watching the breath and like, okay, why am I going to watch the whole breath? Why am I going to watch the whole breath? Why am I keep thinking, oh, there's another thought. Oh, there's another thought. No, my body's itchy. This is so annoying. Why this is happening to me? I've been doing this for 15 years. I can't believe this is happening. It's so unfair. This person just comes and they're sitting so still. This is my 10th retreat already. And my hasn't still settled down. So this kind of thinking, criticizing, analyzing, comparing brings, you know, a lot of suffering, a lot of tension. So after a while, you start to let all those things go. You know, it doesn't matter what people are doing around you. It doesn't matter what the body is doing. Yeah, okay, the body is always a bit achy somewhere. It's not the end of the world. You can still sit with an achy body. You can still sit with a sleepy body. It's just sleepiness. Just stay there and watch it. You sleep. You can sit with a restless mind. It's just thinking. You're not the first person to have a restless mind. I guarantee you, not, you won't be the last person to have a restless mind. That's okay. Mind's just restless. So you just get to know, just be with these different things. And then, and the beauty of this, just being with it, just allowing things to be, things settle down, become more still all by themselves. You don't have to do anything. And then you start to learn, that's how things work. The more contentment I have, the more gratitude, the lower my expectations are, not wanting anything, the mind becomes still all by itself. Oh, maybe this is how, this is the way I practice. Just sitting, being with things. And that's why, you said, like I said, you know, the stimuli of like the lotus petal. You know, the external one's always dirty and grubby and silly. And then the internal one is beautiful, subtle, pure and white. And it's the same with the mind. It's not, you know, as you go deeper inside, things become more still, brighter, all by themselves. But it's an inclining inwards that happens by itself. It's not because you want to get there, or you're pushing or pulling or the different control levers in your mind. It's just this kind of gentleness, this non-wanting, non-craving, this no expectation. I'm just sitting here, just feeling so blessed, so lucky, just to be sitting here for a weekend, for 15 minutes, just sitting, have a healthy enough body to sit, watch my breath. Even if, okay, maybe he's not watching my breath, and maybe a bit thinking, a bit of soreness in the body, a bit of sleepiness, okay, I'm just going to sit. And then things become more still, and then you can watch the breath. And then the breath stays there, because you're not trying to go beyond it. You're not trying to look for, you're not fault finding with the breath. Oh, it's not the right breath, I don't like this breath. I want a more smooth breath. Why is this breath so, so sharp and short? I want a smooth, long one. I want this beautiful breath. Ajahn Brahm talks about the beautiful breath. Why is my beautiful breath going to come up? I don't like this breath. But then you sit there, but you know, that's okay. It's not the best breath, but it's not the worst breath. I just sit with it and see what happens. And then the breath becomes beautiful breath all by itself. Beautiful breath. It's not the beautiful breath, my term. It's more of like the perfect breath, perfect for you. It's not beautiful in a way, but it's perfect. Just the way it is. It's just so perfect. Just the breath. And as you sit there quietly, the breath becomes perfect on its own. It just goes in, goes out, over and over again. And because you're not craving, not planning, not pushing, not pulling, you're there with the breath from the beginning all the way to the end, all the way back in again. Each inhalation, each exhalation naturally, it stays there. But you're not doing anything. You're just enjoying it. And the peace and the stillness, the happiness starts to grow. And that starts to kind of keeps you, your interest in the breath. Not because you're exerting your force, your willpower onto the breath, but it happens naturally because there's a happiness. There's a peace, there's enjoyment. You enjoy watching the breath. It just becomes, you know, kind of, yeah, pure enjoyment, being with the breath. And it's just there, breath after breath after breath. And the mind becomes more brighter, more clear. And then things start to happen. It happens naturally as a cause. It's not something that you're doing. And then after you realize, okay, yeah, it starts out just being happy, being grateful, being still, just allowing things to happen. Yeah. And then so much of the practice is just allowing things to happen. Okay, you got to keep away, you know, kind of a bit of stirring in the beginning, steering away from negative emotion, staying away from the craving, but then after a while, you know, things start to happen by itself. And then, you know, as you become deeper in meditation, there's less you can do. Any movement of thought, any wanting, any craving will shatter the peaceful, the stillness of the meditation. And you realize that after a while, you know, these things don't come up. The mind just inclines inward, inclines more stillness by itself. And then as your mind inclines more stillness, you realize where is true happiness. It's not through managing. It's not through getting your way. It's allowing things to be. Even on a day-to-day level, there's managing, there's doing. Obviously, I have plenty of managing and doing I have to do. But you also understand, yeah, that's just, you do that, but you don't expect everything to go your way. You don't expect the people certainly to do exactly according to your wishes. But you just put it out there and you realize people act, situation will unfold according to the causes and condition. Unfold the way it does. And you know, Ajahn Chah's famous phrase is, you know, it shouldn't be this way. People should always look after the toilets. They shouldn't get up and have streak marks everywhere, especially among toilet. They should have it clean. But no. Things are the way they are because they are that way. If it shouldn't be that way, it wouldn't be that way, right? So if you know, any monks complain, oh, Ajahn Chah, this monk is doing this, he shouldn't be doing that, he should be doing this. Obviously, he shouldn't be doing it, but he is doing it, and it's just the way it is. And you know, and so much peace and stillness comes from, yeah, making peace with the way it is, seeing things clearly. It happens according to causes and condition. If it shouldn't be this way, it wouldn't be this way. Why? And one of those ways, and that's why wisdom brings equanimity. When you understand why people behave the way they do, according to their own defilements, according to the craving that's in their mind, then you don't see it as a personality. You don't take it personal that they're doing it just to annoy you, or you know, they're doing it, you know, to get back at you or to punish you. You know, they're doing it because, you know, they, according, you know, at that time, specific time, they think it's the right thing to do. Out of their own delusion and not seeing clearly. And obviously, you know, remember when you get into an argument, there's always two sides of the story. Everybody thinks they've got the right side. Everybody thinks that they have the right view of life and how things should be done and how things should be acted and what brings happiness. And that's why, and from time to time, you'll see, you understand, yeah, people, you know, do it because they think it would bring them happiness. But obviously, if they don't see clearly, they will bring suffering to themselves and suffering to the people around them as well from time to time. Because obviously we affect each other. Which is fine. You understand that? You don't take it personal. You realize, okay, yeah, this is, you know, when people have defilements of the mind, have craving, have attachment, they will act from it. And that's fine. So the only way to have a perfect monastery is to only let arahants come in. Only let stream enterer for non-lay people come in. We have to have a test, a part of the application process. No, obviously that's not the way to go. The way to go, what I find really inspiring with, you know, just with, not with monks and nuns in the monastery, but also with the lay community who comes to the monastery, is not that you guys are perfect in your behavior. You're pretty close, but not that you're perfect. But, and same with the monks, you know, we have our issues and our challenges. So, you know, I'm not the type, and I was never the type, that get inspired because people are so beautiful and so lovely and so full of metta when they go, most of, no, I'm not the type. But the thing that impressed me when I was at Wapananichai was actually I became a monk just to prove them opposite. It's like, no, it's impossible. They can't keep all the rules. They must be doing something funny. They must be eating the room. I ain't going to join them for 1 year and write a book. and tell our book about these scallywag monks, about what mean things, the terrible things they're doing when the people are not watching. But they're not perfect, that's for sure. But the thing that I found really inspiring, really, with the monks when I first met them at Wat Phan Arachan, was that they've got the issues and problems and weaknesses and shortcomings, but they're trying. They're really trying to practice. And I found that the intention is really beautiful. It's the same with the lay people come. Obviously, people have their issues, but they're trying. At least they're inclining towards Dhamma, inclining towards, you know, practicing, restraining unwholesome and encouraging the wholesome. And that's very beautiful. And you don't see that in the world at all. Sometimes the world is going the opposite direction, inclining towards more, you know, selfishness, inclining towards, and not even caring, not even wanting to change, or thinking that they should change. And at least people here, you know, at least we have, you know, the example of the Buddha, example of the Forest, you know, the Thai Forest Meditation Master, an example of each other, of learning from each other. You see someone behaving in a kind of unskillful way, you see that it brings, you know, suffering. So you're like, okay, yeah, you should try not to do that. You try to always incline towards a skillful way to bring, you know, happiness for yourself and others around you. You see that, you know, thoughtfulness, caring brings happiness to yourself and others. Remember, it's the law of karma. Whatever it is that you want, give that to others. You want love, give that to others. You want to be happy, make other people happy around you. Give happiness to the world, and it comes back to you in many, many ways. You want a sense of well-being, you want respect, you want care and attention. Well, give that to the world around you, and it comes back tenfold. And that's the beauty of being in the monastery, beauty of the Buddhist practice, is it encourages these wholesome aspects. It encourages, you know, training the mind in different ways. Yeah, you know, maybe I'll take, you know, several lifetimes, several hundred lifetimes. But it's a path of beauty, path of inner peace, path of increasing happiness and joy. And that's the beauty, that's what the Buddha, you know, laid down. And you see that for yourself. Okay, you're not perfectly enlightened just yet. But you see that, you know, all the attachment you had that you let go, or different ways that you're behaving before that's unskillful, that you're more skillful now, or at least you have insight, oh yeah, I wasn't so skillful. Well, may I not do that in the future? So you see that the path that you know, are walking on brings a sense of well-being, brings a sense of peace, brings a sense of, you know, of stability in yourself and the world around you. And that's the beauty and the wonderful thing, the preciousness, the value of the Buddha's teaching. Was that he taught, obviously, about stress and suffering, but also showed us the way to happiness, to ultimate happiness. So leave that for your reflection on the Buddha's teaching of suffering and the end of suffering.
Andamayam ovada dhamma kataya sadhu karam dadama se.
Sadhu, 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 sambhuto bhagava buddhang bhagavantang abhivade. Akato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami. Supatipanno Bhagavato Sāvaka Sangho Sanghang Namassami.